Topic number 5, depressed or just feeling blue. Roughly 10% of the U.S. adult population, that is roughly 17 million people, suffer from depression. And 6 million among these seek treatment each year for clinical depression. Allow me to describe what is clinical depression and then talk about how it differs from other sad, low moods that all of us are likely to experience at one or another point in our lives. Depression is diagnosed and classified in the psychiatric handbook, the DSM-4, as characterized by the following symptoms. At least one episode for a 2-week period of depressed mood, that is, sadness, hopelessness, feeling down, for most of the day, nearly every day, that the person can feel and observe in his or herself, as well as can be observed by others, or a lack of interest or pleasure, sometimes described as anhedonia, that is, I might have at one point loved to go to a sports event, and now I find over the past several weeks I'm not interested. I don't want to go, I don't want to read about it, I don't want to talk about it, the loss of interest. This is frequently accompanied by at least 4 of the following symptoms, either a reduction in weight, or atypically, some people put on weight in a period of depression. Similarly, interruption in sleep. When we are depressed, it's very difficult to sleep through the night. Frequently, there are early morning awakenings, like at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning, and difficult time going back to sleep. Atypically, some people experience what's called hypersomnia, that is, they sleep all the time and have a hard time getting up. Changes in our energy level, feelings of fatigue, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, inability to concentrate, and some people experience suicidal ideation, either active suicidal ideation, where I'm planning to do something to harm, kill myself, or passive suicidal ideation, just wishing that the world would collapse upon me and end the misery that I'm experiencing. Some associated features include tearfulness. Often the subcategory is melancholy, depression with melancholy. When there is tearfulness, a person can't stop crying during the day. Anxiety is a very frequent associate, correlate of depression. Irritability, and excessive concern with physical health. The kind of psycho or somatic preoccupation can be a frequent correlate of depression. Now, depression can also have a psychotic side to it. People, for example, who experience hallucinations, perceptions of things that are not there, voices that berate the person, for example, for her or his sins or shortcomings, or delusions, unwanted thoughts that, for example, one has transgressed morally or that one is being persecuted. These, of course, are examples of psychotic depression. The average age of onset for clinical depression is in the 20s, but it really can begin at any age. And we know, for example, that among the elderly, there is a very high prevalence of depression, which is frequently masked, because with younger people who are engaged in work, we're more likely to observe reductions in energy, fatigue, tearfulness. Whereas with the elderly who are detached from work, and we can often ascribe their fatigue or listlessness to aging, to the ordinary aging process, and not consider that this may indeed be symptomatic of clinical depression. The course of depression is variable. Most often, we're able to isolate an acute psychosocial stressor, some loss or major transition that occurs, and a person becomes depressed in the wake of that incident. But sometimes depression develops gradually over days and weeks. The good news about depression, however, is generally the prognosis is very good. Even if depression were left untreated, that is, without psychotherapy or medication, it generally would resolve on its own in 6 months or so, where the person would return to their pre-depression level of functioning. The danger, of course, in letting depression go untreated is that the toll is high on a person's social and occupational functioning. And, of course, there is the suicide risk. And so we want to intervene with depression as soon as possible so that a person can avoid these potentially life-threatening consequences. Now, depression has to be differentiated from other kinds of mood disorders. A few words about them. One such disorder is called dysthymia. And dysthymia is a low-level, low-grade depression. It's not as severe as clinical depression, but it can last for a long time. Diagnostically, it's classified as lasting at least a two-year period, with 2 months without any depressive symptoms in that two-year period. So you've got a very long duration of mild depression with dysthymia. The much more severe differential diagnosis from clinical depression is bipolar disorder. And of course, as the name suggests, bipolar is the opposite poles happening at the same time in terms of mood, where you have on the one hand all of those symptoms of depression as described, but on the other hand, all of the symptoms of mania. So mania symptoms include a sense of grandiosity, I can't sleep, I keep talking. I had a patient early in my career who would say, describe the manic symptom as, I can't talk fast enough to keep up with the thoughts that are being generated in my head. So it's that kind of pressured speech, flight of ideas, and agitation. And with bipolar disorder, you could have a person going from one pole to the other, rapid cycling, we refer to that as, and of course, the more a person cycles from one pole to the other, the worse the prognosis will be. So it's very important to be able to diagnose bipolar disorder. Often when a person presents with depression, not often, always, the good diagnostician will always inquire about the possibility of mania, because the bipolar diagnosis is a much more serious diagnosis. The prognosis is not as good, unfortunately. It tends to be very guarded, and the person needs medication and support and monitoring and lots of aid to help them to deal with that very debilitating condition. Now, there are also some organic factors that can explain why we're feeling sad or low that may not be purely psychological in the case of clinical depression. For example, hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism, will account for mood levels. If we're hyperthyroidism, we'll almost present more like the manic pole. Lots of energy, difficulty slowing down, all that pressure. But if we have hypothyroidism, then where those thyroid-specific hormones are low, that will look like depression. That will be sadness. Diabetes is another organic condition that will occasion mood shifts. All kinds of brain diseases like Parkinson's disease or strokes. There's a 30 to 50% prevalence of depression in people immediately following a stroke. We see that not only changes in their speech and other neurological changes, but also changes in mood accompany this. And that people should know that. I remember in the case of my own father, when he had a stroke, I was unprepared for the mood changes that would happen as a consequence of that brain accident. And so it does remit with time, but there's an important need for an understanding that that can be a normal part of recovery from the assault to one's brain that is a stroke. Of course, various flus and infections and dementia of the Alzheimer's type is also something that accounts for depression. Different cardiovascular illnesses will also occasion depression, emphysema or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, etc. Depression could also result from prescribed drugs. You know, analgesics, painkillers will often set off depression. Or antihypertensives, people who are taking medication for blood pressure, often will experience sedation or lethargy, some of that sleep disturbance and difficulties concentrating that are all symptomatic of depression. And of course, heart attacks. And people are often put on diuretics after a heart attack can also occasion depression. Uncomplicated bereavement is another cause of depression that is different than clinical depression. And what do I mean by that? Of course, when any of us suffers the loss through death of a significant person in our lives, we are sad. This is, of course, a normal reaction to loss. And this reaction varies in intensity from person to person. There are cultural influences, there are age differences, developmental influences, all kinds of reasons to account for why one person grieves in one way and another in another way. When the bereavement is accompanied by a prolonged preoccupation with worthlessness, I should not be here. I don't deserve to live after this person is gone. Or prolonged functional impairment. And again, it's difficult to specify the time on that, whether it's 6 months, a year, 2 years. Kind of as clinical lore, if a person is grieving beyond 2 years, we tend to think of that as pathological. But again, these things have to be gauged on an individual basis. We start to think about complicated bereavement. And then finally, adjustment disorders. You know, again, if we break up with someone or there's a separation, something to occasion an adjustment, there will be depressed mood. But again, the course there is variable. And symptoms with adjustment disorder usually resolve within 6 months. We are remarkably resilient human beings. And we can endure a lot, and we do endure a lot in the course of living. So while adjustment disorder is felt very intensely, it does pass. Now, frequently, there are what we call comorbid, that is, existing at the same time as depression, another disorder or another diagnosis that needs to be considered. Probably chief among them is substance abuse. You know, often people who are abusing alcohol or drugs are doing so to self-medicate, and particularly to self-medicate depression. There is a bit of a chicken and egg problem with depression and substance use, that is, not knowing which one causes the other. Do I use drugs because I'm depressed, or am I depressed because I use drugs? That remains a research question. But the relevance for our purposes is that drugs, particularly alcohol, but opiates as well, and cocaine and other kinds of substances, are about mood and mood regulation. We generally use drugs for a purpose. Painkiller, subscription painkiller medication is highly prevalent today. People, especially young people, can get started with this medication for appropriate reasons to medicate some injury, pain experienced from an injury, but then they get hooked into the medication and they find relief initially, and then they become physically as well as psychologically dependent. And of course, that's problematic and for a whole host of reasons. Personality disorders are also associated with depression. These inflexible, maladaptive patterns of thinking and feeling and behaving will set a person up for chronic feelings of emptiness and suicidal thoughts and gestures that are associated with depression. Now, where does depression come from? There are many theories out there. The model that most mental health providers adopt is called a biopsychosocial model. And biologically, there are probably genetic markers why some people become depressed. Neurotransmitter, that is serotonin and dopamine and other kinds of chemicals in the brain, have been associated from a biological perspective with depression. Psychologically, we know that there are developmental factors that may predetermine one for depression. For example, if I had cold and rejecting parents, I've already earlier in the course talked about the life traps of abandonment and emotional deprivation and mistrust. These, of course, are precursors not only to those life traps, but to the depression that is associated with those life traps. There are also cognitive factors associated with depression. Aaron Beck, one of the forefathers, founding fathers, if you will, of cognitive behavioral therapy for depression, talks about the cognitive triad, that is, negative views of myself, of the world, and of the future that are associated with depression. There are many silent assumptions, like if I am not loved by everyone, then I am unworthy, and all kinds of logical errors that we can make when we are depressed, drawing conclusions. If we fail at something, concluding that we'll never succeed at anything, or blaming ourselves for things that we never did. And of course, there are behavioral factors associated with depression, like social isolation or a lack of pleasant activities. I will often encourage people who come to me to treat their depression to do something, anything, to do, take a walk, to sit outside, to make a phone call, to do something, to kind of get the wheels in motion to reverse the effects of depression. Now, there are many treatment options that exist for depression. If depression is mild, spiritual interventions can be very effective. For example, seeing a spiritual director, or engaging pastoral counseling to deal with depression, can evoke hope. And I would like to spend a few moments on hope and evoking hope as a way to deal with depression. Now, again, I make a distinction between dealing with mild depression versus moderate to severe depression. If we're looking at depression that is moderate to severe, where some of those symptoms of low energy and inability to sleep, or sometimes people can't even get out of bed, then that needs to be evaluated for some pharmacological or medication intervention. But with mild or mild to moderate depression, the spiritual and psychological interventions can be very helpful even without medication. Now, about hope. Hope as a will to survive, to recover, to learn, even in the face of adversity or disease, depends on someone to hope in. So often there is this existential vacuum that depressed people experience who don't know, who can I live for? Why am I here? And to be able, from a spiritual perspective, to locate God as the reason for living, the one in whom I can place my hope, can be life-saving for the person. To use the Psalms, which repeatedly articulate this theme, I will hope in God, I will praise Him still, my Savior and my God. Hope as a horizon to expand my view of myself, to see beyond the present circumstances, to experience imagined possibilities and transcendent, to connect with that which is larger than myself in isolation. Many people are attracted to religion and spirituality precisely out of this longing to be a part of something that is greater than just me, to be a part of a mission that is greater than my own career goals or ambitions, to know that my story connects with a larger narrative, and that the end that I see may be one that would otherwise make me depressed or despondent, is not the final end, and that the horizon is much larger than the one that I can immediately perceive. Hope as a wish, a desire, an intention. To use petitionary prayer, for example, to allow myself to pray for others. We know, for example, that altruism has been associated with a relief from depression. If I get involved in helping other people, well, from a prayer perspective, to be able to pray for other people can have these beneficial effects, not only on the people for whom I pray. In faith, we of course believe that we do send God's Spirit. We engage God's Spirit for the benefit of the person we're praying for, who may be dying or ill or separated from us. But also on the prayer, that hope as wish can be restored and refreshed. And finally, hope as action. That despite the adverse circumstances that may occasion my depression, I continue to inspire hope in others. Viktor Frankl, of course, writes about this in Man's Search for Meaning, where despite the horrible circumstances in which he finds himself in the concentration camp, he is able to locate sources for hope by sharing bread with another prisoner, doing something for another person, encouraging and bringing hope to others. This, in our context of spiritual life and development, is all about not only having a personal experience of faith and belief in God, but sharing that belief and values with other people, and in so doing, finding the hope for living and a reason to go on despite the transitory experiences of sadness that might dampen or otherwise kill the spirit.